Good morning. You're listening to WDRT in Viroqua. My name is Steve Brandl. The name of the show is Conversations. And today we're lucky to be having Dan join us. And Dan is with United Country Oakwood Realty here in town. They're experts in the field of real estate. So Dan, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Steve. It's good to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
So it seems real estate is always on everyone's mind and in the news and that sort of thing. But let's start with you. Tell us about your business, how you got started, how long you've been in business, your family, whatever you'd like to share.
Sure. So I've been with United Country Oakwood Realty since 2005. I bought the business from Dave and Christy Reed, who owned it at the time. I've owned the business since 2006 and became the broker in 2008. My wife, Rhonda, she works in the real estate business with me. She's also a teacher, so that's her her other job and her main love. But we work together, and we have some really neat people in our company. We also have Jeff Dixon, who's known as the Driftless Realtor, and Dylan Martino. And both great people, both really, we all value the individual, and we value the individual's needs when it comes to real estate, and we all try our best to help a person find the property they want to find or sell the property they want to sell.
Okay.
We have our business, our office is right down from the Anger Center on the corner of Washington and Decker, and we also, you probably heard of WDRT as well. We sponsor Something for Seniors, and Bev Schultz is a big part of that that effort with us.
Great. And a real part of the community, so thanks for doing that, and thanks for joining us. And is United Country, is that like a national brand, or is that a regional brand, or how does that work?
United Country is a national brand. It's actually started in 1925. In 1928, It published its first real estate catalog, and that's in the Smithsonian Institute as the first real estate catalog. And what's interesting is it was always about selling rural America properties to people in the cities. So it started out in Missouri, Kansas City, Missouri, and you'd see that first catalog. It's fun to look at that because you can buy 800-acre farms for $3,000. If we all could have bought land back then, right, that would have been great.
Had we known.
Had we known, that's right. And so it's a national franchise. And what we say, we specialize in rural America. When we pride ourselves and claim that no one sells more land and country homes than United Country Real Estate. But we also have special websites in terms of commercial homes in town, golf course properties, restaurants. We really cover it all, but the focus is these communities in rural America.
Okay, and then Oakwood is your
correct
portion of the pie, or
that's
something
right
like that. And what is Oakwood? So, in general, what I we'll talk about multiple listing services and things like that later. But what do you consider your area of service
in terms of geographical?
Yeah.
Okay, so we're located here in Vernon County, but we also work in Crawford County, Richland County. We work at times in Grant County, Monroe County. We've sold properties and listed in La Crosse County as well. So we do, we sold a house this year in the Milwaukee area. So we do expand quite a bit, but our main geographical area is Vernon, Crawford, and Richland.
Okay.
And then some in Monroe.
And I'm sure as the conversation continues, we're going to talk about the MLS or multiple listing service. Mm-hmm. Just give us a brief snapshot of what that means and what that is.
First of all, to belong to the multiple listing service, you have to be a realtor. Some people don't know there's a difference between a real estate agent and a realtor. A realtor is someone who has a little more responsibility in a sense in terms of the ethics in real estate. And when you are a realtor, you can belong to an MLS. And our local MLS is based out of our headquarters is La Crosse, and it means multiple listing service. So what's nice about the MLS is it keeps everything uniform, so everyone has to do things the same way, but it really gets the word out there in terms of a person's listing. So Once you're on the MLS, every other agent can see your listing. Those agents probably have subscriptions they send out to buyers. They can see your listing. We allow Zillow, Trulia, Realtor.com, and other sites to take our listing and information. So when you see something on Zillow, usually that's come right, the data has come right from the MLS. So the MLS is just another way to market. It's to get, it's greater exposure. And it also means you're held to a ethical and a higher level of responsibility.
Okay, mm-hmm. Great. So we understand that part of it now. And let's start by talking about just the real estate market in general in the area. And stop me or correct me if I'm making assumptions that aren't correct. Mm-hmm. But it seems like, and we've owned our own home, my family has owned our own home for 30 years now, so I'm kind of out of the loop on what's really happening. You get tidbits and you get things on social media and you see postings on social media where the real estate market is challenging, it's tight, there's not a lot of homes available. What, from a realtor's perspective, tell me what you see out there right now.
Okay, so, you know, there is a pattern that even though we're local and it's a little different than other places, there is a general pattern that does seem to be the same, like, you know, throughout the country. And there are exceptions. But right now, we're in a, and the market is, it's not that it's crazy or I mean, it's, there's always a challenge to it because it's always changing. It's like the economy. But it helps to understand it, which is another reason why it's important for a buyer or seller, you know, to talk to a realtor. But right now, we're seeing something that it's a little surprising, I think, because there was a time during the recession of 2008 when the builders stopped building. And so the average number of new construction homes in the United States was way below average up until maybe 4 years ago, and then it kind of reached average again. So as a result, there's this big undersupply of homes. Now, when COVID came and interest rates went down very, very low, a lot of the homes that were available got eaten up fast. With that, with interest rates now rising and a lot of those properties gone, because of supply and demand, there was still now a shortage of homes out there. And we still saw quite a strong demand, even with the interest rates going up. It wasn't as fast and furious, but there was still a seller's market, we call it. So a seller's market, if a property is on the market for, say, 6 months, that's like a balanced market. If it's less than that, it's more of a seller's market. If it's more than that, it's more of a buyer's market. So we're still, you know, we've been in a seller's market for a long time. Now, are you getting multiple offers, jumping way above asking price? It depends on the property, and it still happens, but not as regularly, not as often as it was happening during COVID. But what's surprising about the market right now, and whether this is because of the election or whether it's because of the holiday season, there's always a little bit of a lull during this time. But even though there is still this undersupply of homes, we're seeing prices starting to come down on some properties. So it almost is feeling like it's becoming more, it is in favor of a buyer right now. And what I talked to a mortgage broker recently, and he had told me that right now the number of applications for new loans for homes is as low as it's been since like the 90s. So why are there not more people buying right now? Well, you know, interest rates are still, I think last time I checked, they were about 6.75. So they're still kind of high, you know, close to that 7. And again, whether it's the elections or whether it's part of the holiday season, but this is a great opportunity right now for buyers because we are seeing some property prices come down. It could be an opportunity for them to get in the door before the spring market hits, which is going to probably be strong and you'll create more demand. So I think that the local Southwest Wisconsin market is echoing what is being felt, you know, overall, you know, nationwide.
Mm-hmm. Is it seasonal? Is it like in spring, everybody goes crazy?
It is. Yeah, I think spring is the best time to list a property. You know, summer's good too. Around this time, I remember hearing once, and I never really followed this, but they say like from Thanksgiving to the Super Bowl is when things might slow down. But you do feel it around this time of the year, you know, around Christmas, and then you have New Year's. There are still showings going on. I have a showing today of a country home. But it does pick up spring. That's a good time. For some reason, it feels like the month of July might be a little slower. Maybe people are vacationing. Mm-hmm. In fall is a good market as well.
Right. Well, that all makes sense. I mean, right now, you know, people got family activities. They're moving around. They don't want to show houses or go running around looking at houses and that sort of thing. And then, like you said, in summer, there's vacation season and that sort. So I guess that's pretty typical. And I, too, have noticed, and, you know, this is completely armchair quarterbacking it or whatever, you know, looking at it out the window of my car. It seems like there are properties that are posted longer, like the signs out, the realtor signs out there, longer than what it has been in the last couple of years or something like that.
Yeah, that's right. And that's why we're seeing some prices come down.
Right.
And you really, you know, we have a pretty extensive process to help sellers try to find that market value before they list. But you really don't know the true value of a property until it's on the market. Then the buyers tell you how it's positioned, I call it, positioned in terms of price on the market.
Right. And another thing that you hear a lot about or see, and maybe this is more in the larger urban areas, but you hear that there's a lot of competition from investors going through and buying homes and buying blocks of properties. Is that mostly the bigger cities, or is that happen in this area as well?
Well, that happens in this area as well. The thing is, right now, I think an investor has to find a really good buy. And there are some people who are cash buyers, and it's easier for them. But because with interest rates being higher, you need to have a higher rent return to make it a good investment. And that makes it a little more difficult to afford a rental property. Will the rent support what you need to pay and what you need to invest on a monthly basis on your own mortgage?
Right. And are those investors really just speculating on the value of that property? They have renters in the interim, or is the rent income the revenue that they're looking for?
Usually the rent income is what they're looking for. That and how much are they going to have to put into the property, if it needs a lot of work or not? And is that all going to balance out in the end? You know, investors, they often say, oh, don't get emotionally attached to a property, because it really is about the numbers. And so that's what is looked at. Not that there's not exceptions. The return needs to make sense for the input.
Right. Just like stocks or anything else. Yeah. It's where you're going to put your money, I guess, if you have that money to invest. So, and those are generally individual standalone investors, or are they buyer groups that are purchasing?
Around here, personally, I see more individual
investors. That doesn't surprise me either. It just,
and there's not as many blocks. There's not as much, you know, it's not like in a city where there might be blocks of places to purchase.
Right.
So I see more individuals.
Yeah, no, not as many housing developments and things like that. That's what you even see around Madison, for example, or something, if you get down to the larger urban areas. But in Viroqua, we do have a larger apartment complex going in. So how do you view that? What does that do to the market in of Viroqua size?
Yeah, I mean, that'll change it, because right now an investor is almost guaranteed they're going to have a renter. You know, there's not enough rentals right now. So when you, with the development that's being done and the extra apartment units that'll be available, it'll certainly make it more competitive for landlords in terms of their rent. You know, in how will it affect the demand, and how quickly, you know, will it become saturated with new renters is a good question. And I don't know how long it's going to, like even those Rock Street apartments, from what I know, you know, they have no problem renting, and there's still a demand and a shortage for apartments.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, you know, this area continues to grow. It continues to be a place where people seek out this lifestyle, the Driftless region. I was talking to someone recently from Illinois just last week, and he said he's, you know, going to be buying a business in the area, and he's looking for a place, you know, some land to buy and to build, or maybe looking for a place that he can buy and then rent out later, or that his family member who might work in the business could rent. And they're just... I have names of landlords I often give out, but the opportunities aren't there. The amount of opportunities, like there will be, you know, when this unit gets completed.
Mm-hmm. And do you get involved in rental properties too? I mean, or do you just connect people? You're in the business to buy and sell real estate. You don't dabble in the other?
Not too much. Now, Dylan Martino, one of our agents in the office, that is his big focus. And he works a lot with commercial properties. And he also is working with a local apartment complex and to find renters and work with the renters because the owner is more a little bit more hands-off. So we do have someone in our office who does that work. And we often work with buyers that want to invest in something like that, and with sellers who want to sell something like that, a property that is a rental.
Okay. So there's that going up. Is there more rental properties or condos in the works for Viroqua and Vernon County? Or,
you know, we don't see a lot of condos, but, you know, there is the development that we know right across from the food co-op there, Kitty Corner, that's being built right now. And then there's also a planned development across from Walmart. And that's going to have, from what I understand, rentals. And it's kind of like a condo idea. There's I think there's four different projects there, and I don't quote me exactly. And there's maybe there's two or three that have already been like plots and that have been purchased or in the works of being purchased. And they will include... from what I have heard now, they will include some rental spaces, kind of a condo idea. They'll also include some duplexes to purchase. There's going to be included some commercial spaces to rent. So there again, we're going to have more opportunities for housing.
Right. And when is that? When's groundbreaking on that? Or any idea?
That's a good question. I don't know when groundbreaking is. And it would happen in different segments because they need, there's four different segments, and I think it's three, have already been spoken for. I talked to one person recently who is invested in one of them or is planning on it, and there still hasn't been the finalization, you know, to get that started, you know, get that groundbreaking. So I'm not as closely connected with that to know the dates and deadlines, but I have talked to people who are involved with it and who've given me, you know, a little bit of a picture of what's happening right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great. Thanks for all the information, Dan. Just going to take a quick station break here. You are listening to WDRT 91.9 FM in Viroqua. My name's Steve Brandle. The name of our show is Conversations. Today, we are lucky to have Dan from the United Country Oakwood Realty office right here in Viroqua giving us a little snapshot of the market and some pointers and tips on properties. So thanks for joining us, Dan. I guess in this next segment, I'd just like to kind of dive into, let's just say you're a young person, maybe a young family, and move into the area. You want to buy your first house. What's the right thing to do as you see it? Like, how would you do that if you were 20 years old or 25 and coming into the marketplace? What are the steps that you would see as being proper?
I think what's important to do is to establish a relationship with a lender. And you might want to talk to a few different lenders or mortgage brokers, because then you're going to know how much of a property you can afford. And if you're buying something that maybe is in the country and maybe has some ag land with it, it might determine what kind of loan you're going to get. Some buyers may be eligible for loans that are low down payment or no down payment loans. But I think that's an important piece, especially because when you put in an offer, it's great to already have your pre-approval letter, as opposed to saying in the offer you'll deliver it within 7 days. Because if a seller has two or three offers, that one that already has a pre-approval letter as part of that offer is going to look more attractive. It's just another feather in your cap. So establish a relationship with a lender. Know how much of a property you can afford and you're comfortable affording. You know, take into account the taxes, and that's a big piece right there. The second is start to refine what you're looking for and what you want. And sometimes that process of refining, you have a general idea, but it doesn't really, until you go look at properties, you know, you may not know for sure. You know, it's important to look. So that means when you look at a property, you have two options. One, you can call the listing agent and they can show you a property. Two, you can hire a buyer's agent. And then that buyer agent will work for you and set up, you know, all the showings and negotiate for you and that type of thing. So it's good to understand this before you start looking. Do you want a representative? Do you want a buyer's agent to represent you? By default, every real estate agent and realtor represents a seller. We have to represent someone. We have to have an agency agreement. We have to have a client. There has to be a client for us to provide brokerage services. And the default really goes to the seller, unless a buyer hires you as a buyer's agent. Then that realtor owes you the duties owed to a client. And part of that is negotiating on your behalf, looking out for your best interest. So that's, I think, if I was going to a new community, I would want to have a buyer's agent. I would want someone to represent me, unless I really knew the community and I really was comfortable with the process. So, and if you're going to hire a buyer's agent, you probably want to check to see who you want to hire. So things you can look at, you can look online. There's Zillow reviews and there's Google reviews. You probably want to look at the experience a person has had. You might want to look at after a realtor's names, if they've gone on to have continuing education other than just your required two-year, you know, biannual continuing ed. There's designations and certifications that realtors can obtain with a lot of good information that actually helps your clients out. And you'll see letters after their names for the different designations and certifications that they've worked towards, if they have worked towards those. So you might want to look to see what's behind their name. You may want to also look into their company. You know, that's particularly important if you're a seller. You know, how do they market? How is this company different than that company? But as a buyer, big things: get involved, establish a relationship with a lender, and determine if you want to have a buyer's agent and who you want that buyer's agent to be.
And is that, I'm assuming that's additional cost if you have a buyer's agent, or does that buyer's agent part of the MLS and they actually do all that work for you?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, and right now the climate's changed a little bit in the last, since August with commissions nationwide. So if you hire a buyer's agent, you are usually saying that you will pay that company, because you're not paying your agent, you're paying the company of the agent, you will pay that company a certain percentage of the purchase price. Now, what usually happens out in the field is when an offer is written, let's say a buyer has agreed to pay a buyer agency's firm 2% of a purchase price at closing. So there's no money that needs to be exchanged up to that point. It depends on the company and the agent, I suppose, how they set things up. But for our company, there's no money exchanged until there's a closing. So let's say there's an agreement that 2% would be what's owed the buyer's agent's company at closing. What typically happens is when an offer is written, a buyer in the offer will ask the seller to pay 2% of their closing costs or towards their buyer agency fees. And we're usually, you know, we're prepared for this now. So a seller is probably prepared for this. And what might also happen is if that company listing the property, the buyer agent will contact the seller's agent and say, are you offering a co-broke? And then that agent will say, yes, we are offering a 2% co-broke, or we're offering a 2.4 or a 1% co-broke. And we try to get that information before an offer is written. So if they're offering a 1% co-broke, the buyers might ask the sellers to pay 1% towards their buyer agency fee. So usually in the field, the way I've seen it happening is the seller, it's negotiated with the seller, or the seller's company is going to contribute towards that buyer agent fee.
Okay.
But in the end, ultimately, it's the buyer's responsibility.
Right.
Yeah.
But it does, and is a buyer's agent that's relatively new in the industry, or has that always been going on? I don't recall.
You know, it's been going on a long time, especially in Wisconsin. Wisconsin has done their contracts really well, and it's been a part of the Wisconsin real estate contracts for a long time. And these forms and these contracts always evolve and change with time and with different issues that come up. But you don't hear about it as much, probably, because most times you think about selling a property and you list it and you have a listing agreement. But for a wise buyer, if they want a buyer's agent, if they want representation, they need to develop that relationship. What happens sometimes is a buyer will see something on Zillow and maybe they'll call the listing agent and they'll see the property. And then they realize that that listing agent doesn't represent them. So now they want a buyer's agent. Well, what makes it a little clumsy in the real estate world, the company that gets paid a commission is the one that has what's called procuring cause, the one that brought in the buyer. So now there's a little bit of a conflict because that listing agent showed the property, which is part of procuring cause, but now the buyer wants to work with a different agent as their buyer's agent. So It is best to set it up by the way we just talked about.
Right.
Get a buyer's agent if you want one. Not all buyers care about that. They just say, I see this listing. I'll work with the listing agent. I'm okay. We still owe customer duties to customers. We have to be fair and honest and use reasonable skill and care. And there's a number of things we owe. But if they want to be represented as a client, you know, establish that relationship.
Okay.
And let that buyer's agent contact these properties that they want to see.
Okay.
The buyer's agent will reach out then to say, I'd like to set up a showing for this property and for this property. They'll contact the listing agent.
Right.
Not the buyer themselves.
Right. Okay, so we determined whether or not we want a buyer's agent. We're going to work directly with the realtor. Again, we're first-time home buyers. We are coming into the marketplace. What are some of the other assumptions, pitfalls, best practices that you suggest to any newcomer?
I would say when it comes time to writing your offer, we always recommend inspections. Now, during COVID, when there's fast and furious offers, competitive, oftentimes home inspections were not even done because they want the sellers to say, hey, this is an attractive offer. There's no inspections. There's no tests. But as realtors, you know, we stress the importance of inspections and tests so that a buyer knows what they're getting. And if you have a contingency that includes an inspection, if something comes up, the contracts are structured in a way where they can ask the seller to remedy, or they can ask for compensation. Or if you're within the deadlines of the offer, you can write a notice of defects of what you object to, which would then kill the offer if the seller will not remedy. So I think they want to start thinking about their contingencies, and this is where their realtor is going to help them. Are they going to have a financing contingency? Do they need a home sale contingency? Are they going to have a home inspection contingency? What about a radon test? Are there anything else? Is there anything else about the property that should be looked at when a realtor looks at a property, whether they're listing it or whether they're working for buyers? We have the obligation to look through that property and to look for any what's called material adverse facts. And then material adverse facts have to be disclosed in writing to all parties in a timely fashion. So we're talking about defects, things that would affect in a significant way the health of the occupants, or that would significantly shorten the normal life expectancy of the premises, of the improvements, like a leaky roof or a foundation that's buckling, or that would have an overall negative effect on the value of a property. Like if there's an easement running right through it and people can walk right through your yard, you know, that type of thing. Those have to be disclosed. But not only those things, and this is where it looks a little tricky for agents at times, and we can kind of wrestle with this. Something that we feel that if a buyer was aware of this, it would affect whether or not they would enter into a contract or the terms of the contract, the contingencies. So sometimes it's a judgment call, and there's a kind of a gray area. But these are the things that we kind of, maybe we're going a little bit further here than the question, but these are all important to a buyer. So contingencies, you know, looking at what defects might be, looking at the documents provided, the real estate condition report that the seller fills out, talking about potential defects in the home, relying on a realtor's disclosures, you know, the disclosures, all that's important to understand the property you're buying. So again, it's education about the property itself when it comes time for an offer.
Okay. And coming in without specialized financing of, you know, like an FHA loan, I don't know if those are still around, what should the assumption be that a buyer has to have in cash to purchase something? Or is that, that's between you and your bank kind of thing? Or what should our assumption be as buyers?
Okay, and you say, and we're not talking about low down payment loans.
Yeah, what's just the standard?
I think if there's a standard, it's 20% down.
20% down.
But people can get 10% down. They might pay pre-mortgage insurance, PMI.
Okay.
So they have some extra expense until they can get beyond that level. But I would say just in general, it'd be 20% down.
And what other initial expenses should I have in mind if I'm a first-time homeowner?
If you're a cash buyer, there's very few.
Right.
But if you have a loan, there's going to be loan costs. You know, there's sellers provide in Wisconsin. This is not all states, but in Wisconsin, the sellers provide and pay for title insurance. But there's also a lender's policy that the buyer ends up paying for. The other additional loan costs, and that would probably be more. More of a question for a lender to really get those broken down and what those are. But the buyer pays to file, to record the deed, which is a $65 fee, right. I think. Most of the costs fall on the seller. Unless you have a loan, then there are lender costs, which is a little hard for me to speak to what each lender would have for their costs.
What's title insurance?
Title insurance is, it ensures that the title of the property that you're buying is free and clear from any encumbrances, any liens. So in Wisconsin contracts, the default is that the seller is going to provide you with title insurance. And so they contact a title company or an attorney that does title work, and they do a title search. They search back to see if there's anything, any problems. You know, does anybody have a first right of refusal? Are there any loans on the property that need to be paid off? Are there easements on that property? Anything that gets recorded shows up in the title insurance. And they're warranting that this buyer is getting, this property is free and clear. There's no encumbrances. And if there are things that go along with that property, the buyer is going to know.
Okay, so tell me if I have this right. So if like I was buying a property from you, the seller, and you put a new roof on it, but you didn't pay that contractor yet. And I bought the property, the cost of that roof, materials, and labor would not fall on me, the buyer. That's what the insurance is for, is protections like that.
Yeah, so if you didn't pay your bill in a timely fashion and the roofer put a lien on the property for right. what was owed, the title company would not close that property until that was taken care of.
Right.
So when you close, the funds get distributed, and one place that goes is to pay off that lien for that new roof.
Sure.
So all those funds come out and so that you have a clean slate.
Right. And what about the big costs of especially a rural property or like septic systems? Like, let's say, does that help protect you against buying a home and then finding out it has a failed septic system or you're going to have to spend $10,000 on a new septic system the first year you own it?
Title insurance would not. And you're good point about rural properties, because there's more involved with a rural property. There are different contingencies that are used for rural properties. There's septic inspections, there's well inspections, there's water tests. You know, there might be a survey. There's different things that are involved, and they're all important. And that's where you would find if there's issues.
Okay.
And there's some septic systems in our county that are just called unknown systems because there's no records. They predate 1969.
Right.
And it's not that the county doesn't allow them. You know, if they were leaking or if they're surfacing any discharge, they're not allowed. But just because they're old and unknown, it's good for a buyer to be aware of that, because there might be a new septic system in the future that's going to be needed.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I understand that septic systems have a great variance in price, but what should one have in his head for a new septic system if you do buy something like we did when we bought 30 years ago, and that was, there was no septic system. It was a pipe.
And I've checked. right. I've seen those.
I bought one.
Yeah, you bought one. Well, and I've asked people about this, in the past at different times, septic installers. And I haven't done it recently, but from what I have gathered recently, I've heard from $8,000 to $30,000. It depends on the kind of system you need. The most expensive system is a mound system, so they bring in a bunch of dirt. And this would be a great question for a septic installer. So I want to qualify this answer. I want to put that in quotations around that. But I've heard it could be up to $30,000. Mm-hmm. But it'd be great to ask your septic installer for sure. And if it's a conventional system, then maybe it's 8 might be a little low, 8 to 12 perhaps.
Yeah, that all sounds right. And what about wells, the other big, that's the other big expense? What should a buyer be inquiring about a well? Just the pump, when was the last time it was replaced? Casements, what's the right thing?
Yeah, that's a good question, because there are DNR records. You find the records for wells in the DNR website, but not all wells have a record. And I've talked to well inspectors about this even recently, and he said, there was a time when some of these well installers were excellent in what they did, but they were lousy with paperwork. And so there just might not be a record on the well. There are old wells that we call them, the tin-cased wells. And one way I think you could even check on a well is if you take a magnet, an inspector was telling me about this recently. You take a magnet and put it on your casing of your well. If it sticks, it's a steel-cased well, which is great. If it doesn't stick, it's probably an old lead or tin well.
Casement.
Which aren't conforming. And sometimes you see the old cisterns wells, which aren't conforming. So wells are expensive. Depends on how high you are. I heard of a seller once saying, we checked into a well. It's like $60,000 up high. But what you can do, if you have a question about what would a well cost on your property, you can call some well drillers, Kuba Well Drilling, Corpion, and you could ask them, because they typically know the area, and they know the house is nearby, and they can give you a general idea of what a new well would cost.
Mm-hmm. But the tin case question versus the steel case question and how old the pump is and stuff, that's legitimate questions that you can ask the realtor or the seller.
You can, and you may not, people may not know, because even sometimes those old tin case wells, they would take a steel casing and put it 15, 20 feet down, and you still have tin case down below that. Yeah. That's what I mean. You know, there's gray areas in real estate, and we do need to disclose things if we're aware of them, but sometimes you're just not aware.
Right. So that's the challenges of buying a rural property is that it's a little, there's less documentation, there's your own septic you have to worry about, there's your own well or water that you have to worry about. And then there's also the easement part of it. And again, just from experience in buying our rural property, there was some questions on like mineral rights, and meaning gravel pits. Like there could have been something signed a long time ago that says whomever, some company, could excavate and come in. So what do you know about that, or what suggestions do you have there?
Well, out west, and that would show up in the title work, but out west, that's a big deal. Western states, mineral rights, huge. Like I was talking to a gentleman who's a geologist and who works, right now they're working on a lithium project out west, and they were telling me that out west, you rarely do you own your mineral rights. So you have to allow someone to come on your property and get at those minerals. Around here, that's quite uncommon. I've been doing real estate now for, close to almost 20 years, and I've had only one property that I'm aware of that had a mineral right. I'm working with buyers near Eau Claire, and it was through the title work where we realized someone had mineral rights on their property. And I'm trying to remember what minerals it even was. But I believe it was like obsolete, or maybe it was past the date or something. But we got it resolved. Everyone was happy that the offer moved through. But there's the important thing of title insurance, right?
Right.
And I don't remember. I think it might have just, maybe they were able to remove it. I have heard of one case, someone around here who said they once sold the property, but they kept the mineral rights to the crops. So, it's out there. It's you don't see it as much. But country properties, that's something, and that would show up in title work. And you're right, easements is something else. Shoreland zoning, that's a big one around here. Shoreland zoning is because of all these ravines we have in the Driftless region. They say that if water runs through there and you can float a kayak once a year, there's shoreland zoning. It's called navigable, even if it's a dry run most of the year. But if you have a little stream, it's navigable if once a year you can float a kayak. And if it's shoreland zoning, then you need to get the county involved with your building process. Because usually these country properties are pretty large. But when you build in shoreland zoning extends 300 feet beyond the high water mark of a navigable stream or a dry run that's navigable once a year. And so that 300 feet, if it's determined to be navigable, and many aren't, but if it is, you got to be 75 feet away from the high water mark to build. You can only develop 15% of that shoreland zoning area with impenetrable or impervious surfaces like a driveway or a house. Now, because we're talking 2, 3, 20, 40 acres of land, it's usually not an issue. But if you have a property that's 1 acre in size and the majority is shoreland zoning, you got to realize that you can only develop 15% of that surface area if it's in shoreland zoning.
Okay.
So that's another thing with country properties that you need to be aware of.
So the bottom line is there's a lot more research that needs to be done if you're buying a country property, even though it's done every day.
That's right. That's right. And people are happy. And most often people get their properties and they just, we all, like you said you had a septic with a pipe sticking out of the ground. I mean, we all buy our properties and then we learn about them.
Right.
And we love them, and we just continue to improve them and We're grateful for what we've got.
Do your research. Yeah. Well, again, Dan, thanks a million for joining us. You are listening to WDRT 91.9 FM in Viroqua. The name of the show is Conversations, and we're talking with Dan from United Country Oakwood Realty today. He's given us all kinds of great suggestions on purchasing property, selling property. So we are very thankful that he could join us today. You're listening to us on Thursday morning at 9 a.m. This show is also archived at WDRT.org. Take a look in the archives for the show Conversations. It's a weekly show with a revolving group of hosts and a revolving group of people they're interviewing, and it's a whole host of different topics. So again, Dan, now that we have people terrified about rural properties.
people love the rural properties,
though. Let's throttle it back. Yeah, we do. And it is, like you said, you just got to do it mindfully and understand where the reality is, like buying anything, buying a car, same thing.
Yeah, you need help.
Right? Yeah. So let's talk about in-town properties, which is it true that that's where I'm sure most people, their first home is an in-town property? Pretty simple. City water coming from the water tower, septic, is a pipe going out to the main system, so it's a lot less risk or a lot less to be concerned about, maybe. You tell me.
Yeah, often more affordable as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of people that love to be in the country, and even though we talked about those potential issues, most often things are just fine, and you become aware of the issues and you deal with them. But properties in town, there are. There's folks that just say, "But I want to be able to be near this school, perhaps, or I love to be able to walk downtown. I want to be close to healthcare." There are fewer things to be concerned about with a property in town. You know, the typical contingencies of a home in town would be a home inspection and a radon test. There's an option for a lead-based paint test. There's not a survey that's done, but a person could have a survey if they wanted to know exactly where their lines are, their corners are. So it's easier. It's an easier process. Yeah, there are less unknowns. And again, it depends on the age of the house too. Some a house that is a very, very old house maybe had some additions, or there can be questions there, as opposed to a house that was built in the last 30, 40 years. So, age of a home can make a difference too in terms of knowing exactly what you're getting. But there are reasons people want to live in town is again proximity, and also. It is simpler, and we do have, and there are properties that are in town, but they also have kind of a country feel. If you're out, like around the outskirts a little bit, or even like Crossing Meadows subdivision, where we have a number of properties that we've listed and sold in there, you have that country feel, but it's still city water and sewer amenities, and golf course access. So there's some neat things there. And then people may be moving from the country in town because they just want to live in a simpler life. So you know what it's like to own a country property. Right. There's always something to do. You know, there's work involved. And if you have a country property, you probably like that. But there comes a time when people would say, okay, I don't need this anymore.
It's hard.
I'm willing to just, I'd rather just have, maybe just worry about my driveway that's not that long. And cutting my little lawn, and it's just less to think about.
Right.
So there's a big draw for being in town. And I think, I see that draw. I see it in families with kids, probably because they're close to schools. I see it in people who are maybe newly retired and want to move to the area because their kids and grandkids are here and they don't want the work of a country property. Sold one not too long ago to a young couple. I believe the Illinois area. They just wanted to be in town, and there's a house on about an acre, which is a nice sized lot, but they wanted to be close to things. Mm-hmm. And But it's just, yeah, it's preferable to some, depending on their lifestyle.
Right. And I don't really follow the real estate market in Viroqua. So you talked about those nice, like, lots that have city water and sewer. Are there dozens of those and dozens available right now that you could build on?
Well, there were, when that development started, there were 52 lots. And then some of those got divided into what are called twindo, or townhouses, like a duplex, where you buy half. So right now there's only, I would say, gosh, I think there's only about 7 or 8 left.
Okay.
Of those lots. And there's some border are right along the golf course. Every one of those lots does have golf course access. Not that everyone golfs who's in there, but it's just a nice perk.
Mm-hmm. And so what kind of, let's just say it's as you described, retiring, don't want the big country property anymore, going to move into town, can't find a house that fits your needs, so you're going to build something. So what should a person have in his head for a very simple ranch-style, 2-car garage, you know, 3 bedrooms, 2 baths? What's the number, Dan?
Yeah. And again, if you want a certain home, you got to check your area you want to build in, because there are covenants and restrictions to these different subdivisions. They allow like a minimum of 1,800 square feet or a minimum of 800 square feet. It just depends where you are. But you know, I've been hearing between $200 and $300 a square foot to build. I talked to someone recently. They said they built for $180 a square foot, which I was like, wow, is that right? But it seems like you're looking for sure between $200,000 and $300,000, mm-hmm. and maybe you're closer to $300,000 right now.
Right.
There are certainly builders a person can talk to in the area who give them a good estimate. You know, a good estimate.
Sure, sure. Mm-hmm. Let's. Anything else on the city purchases or ideas that people should be thinking
about?
Well,
I mean, and this is just, we were talking about Crossing Meadows. You know, they're right now, one of the hottest commodities out there have been these townhouses, because they're like zero entry level. There's not a step up, low maintenance, brand new storage, a nice community out there. And we do have a couple more being just getting started. We're actually going to list them today, but they're not even built yet. But there are opportunities in the city to get something new. And that are easy. They're not like the two-level, two-story
right.
homes.
Brady Bunch.
Right, right. I think, you know, I think with, in terms of in town, you know, I think we've covered the most important components
okay.
of when thinking of buying
great.
In town.
Great. And then From a seller's perspective, because we're getting down with about 5 minutes left here in the show, what are the considerations, or again, common mistakes people make or ideas they have in their head from a selling standpoint? Let's say I want to sell my property. When do I reach out to a realtor? How do I establish a price value on my property? That sort of thing.
Yeah, and I think one of the most important things, at least it has been for me in my career, is getting at that market value.
Mm-hmm.
And when I work with people, they'll invite me to their homes. We look at the home, and I'll go do my homework. We look at what closed in the last year, similar properties. We adjust those to make them better reflect your property, and we look at what's on the market, what's pending, and with all that information, I'm summarizing this. With all that information, then we come up with like a market range, or we believe. And you will too. You, through this process, the seller gets a good feel too for where that house could sell for, where it should be positioned. So the most important thing is get that market analysis. And we do offer those. If someone's really thinking of selling, we do offer those for free. We'll come and do that. The other thing you want to think about as a seller is who do you want to represent you, because they're working for you, and what company? Do you want a national franchise with more marketing exposure? Do you want, what do you want in terms of the experience of someone who's been in real estate? Maybe look at the reviews again. But you want to think about how you're going to prepare your house as well. And general rule of thumb is when you're listing a home, you want a person to walk into your home and feel like they can see themselves in it. So a few things. We want to reduce clutter. We want things very clean. And that includes your basement. Get rid of cobwebs. Your front entry is very important. It sets the tone, sets the stage. Maybe get rid of some of the personal pictures. It's sort of not inundated. You know, the refrigerator, take them off the fridge. So you're really trying to set, you're setting the stage for someone to say, oh, I can see myself in this home. And we go through that process of what you can do to make it more sellable and to make it appealing to a buyer.
Okay. And then once you have a realtor working for you, you kind of step away and just deal with offers and things like that that are proposed to you or emotionally, what else?
And there is emotions that get involved with real estate. That is for sure.
Right.
But the realtor handles everything. I mean, the realtor will guide the seller. The realtor will let the seller know in their showings, but the seller is always in control. The seller can choose to accept or not accept an offer. The seller can say, you know what, the showing won't work tomorrow at 9, but tomorrow at 3 will work. So you're always in control. There's certain things we agreed to in a listing agreement. You're going to cooperate with our marketing, with our being able to show it. But you have the final word. We work, for you. So yeah, you basically step back and let us go about our work. We do pictures. We do descriptions. We might send it our description to you so you can review it, see if everything looks good, or maybe we missed something or misrepresented something. There is really then in the hands of the company. And you also have, I think there's even a bit of protection, maybe, or is that the right word or not? But you're hiring a company to do for you and to watch out for you and to look out for your best interests. And with that, we have a certain responsibility and liability. So it really, best case scenario, it's a seamless process. And we try to make it that way for sellers. And most of the work is done, with the realtor.
Great. Well, thanks a million, Dan, for joining us today. We could obviously go on for hours, but I'm sure if folks have any other questions, they can feel free to reach out to you. You have a great website. I was looking at that over the weekend, and they can contact you. You're right in town here in Viroqua. Dan from United Country Oakwood Realty, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Steve. Great to be here.